You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you from the sunny climes of Western Japan here in May of 2025 with episode 476 of The Corbett Report podcast. I read Conspiracy Theory in America, and you can too. Yes, so speaking of calling things by their right name, which I hope my well-informed audience knows by now is the title of a recent Solutions Watch exploration of the importance of finding the right nomenclature for things. Well, obviously one that pertains to a lot of the subject matter that I cover and that I have no doubt that Corbett reporteers have heard if they have ever tried to spread this information to others is the old conspiracy theorist slur slash pejorative slash thought-stopping cliche. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, which of course is meant as a label to thereby essentially say that you are crazy or imply that you are crazy and that anything you have to say on any matter can be dismissed out of hand. And so you might have noticed that I have attempted to seed the counter to that thought-stopping cliche into my own vernacular, and I would like to hope that it catches on. No, I'm a conspiracy realist, which very quickly, I think, reframes that pejorative slash slur, the conspiracy theorist slur, into something that is immediately understandable, but also flips it on its head. No, I'm a conspiracy realist, as in conspiracies happen all the time, and I am realistic about that. What are you? Are you unrealistic? Anyway, I like to think that that's one way of getting under the hood of what is going on with that deliberately implanted piece of psychological manipulation. But how about this? Maybe instead of being a conspiracy realist, I should proclaim that I am a SCAD realist. What, you've never heard of SCAD? You don't know what SCAD stands for? You don't know what that means? Well, if you stick with me today, you will know all about SCAD, because in the lengthy and beloved tradition of such previous Corbett Report podcast episodes as episode 461, I read The Most Dangerous Superstition, and you can too. Yes, today I present to you episode 476 on I Read Conspiracy Theory in America, and you can too. And for those not in the know, Conspiracy Theory in America is the title of a book by Lance DeHaven Smith that was published by the University of Texas Press back in 2014. It is available for purchase from utpress.utexas.edu, and I will put the link in the show notes, of course, so that you can go and purchase a copy of this book, physical or electronic, if that tickles your fancy. Or there's even an audiobook version that is available in various booksellers. But I will also provide the link to the archive.org PDF version that has been supplied by, well, it's attributed to Lance DeHaven Smith in the archive post. Anyway, it is up on archive.org for a free viewing, at least at the time that I'm recording this, so I'll throw that link in too, in case you do not have any pennies to spare on this. But having said that, yes, the point of today's episode is to introduce to you a very, very important book that you probably haven't heard of yet, but you should, because I dare say, if I may be so bold, this is a modern classic of conspiracy realist literature that deserves to be on your bookshelf next to other modern classics like, I don't know, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. Okay, maybe that is a little bit too bold, but you get what I'm saying. This is an important book. And why? Because I know what you're thinking. I understand that for most people in my audience, when they hear a book published by a university press, by some sort of academic about conspiracy theory in America, I know exactly what type of book you expect this to be, because I have had cause to note and talk about the way conspiracy theory literature is treated in the press in the past. One of the most popular articles to be written in recent decades is titled, Why Do People Believe in Conspiracies? It starts by noting the worrying rise in the number of people who believe in wild, outlandish theories about how people in positions of power conspire to maintain their influence and expand their wealth. The article's author then cites a psychologist who explains that well-meaning but emotionally unstable people typically latch on to these fantastical conspiracy theories because they help these poor, deluded souls make sense of the news and offer them a feeling of control over an uncontrollable world. Next, the report offers advice to those who are seeking to disabuse anyone who has fallen for this conspiracy claptrap of their delusional notions. That advice, it turns out, is the same admonition given to someone coming upon a wild animal in the jungle. Don't confront the target directly or make them angry. Speak to them in soothing tones and pretend to listen to what they're saying. And disengage if it seems they're preparing to attack. But this article usually ends on a positive note. If this wild conspiracy theorist that you're talking to hasn't completely lost touch with reality, then it may be possible to talk them down from the ledge. You can gently create some cognitive dissonance in their mind by pointing out that every conspiracy that has ever occurred in history has been exposed by whistleblowers and reported on by journalists, and therefore, there's no such thing as a secret conspiracy. If they're of sound mind, this will be enough. Your confused friend will see the light and learn to trust government and authority once again. Do you want to read this article? Would you like a link? Well, I don't have one link for you. I have dozens. You see, the curious thing about this "Why Do People Believe Conspiracies?" article is that it hasn't been written just once or twice. It's been written hundreds of times by hundreds of different journalists. And it's been published by the BBC and 538 and Vox and the American Psychological Association and the New York Times and Psych Central and Addiction Center and LSU and Technology Review and National Geographic and Very Well Mind and Business Insider and Psychology Today and Harvard and Live Science and Scientific American and NBC News and The Conversation and Intelligencer and Time, and The Guardian, and Popular Mechanics, and even that most prestigious of journalistic institutions, Goop. Yes, Goop. What was that, you're wondering to yourself? Well, I'm glad you asked. That, in fact, is a bit of a sneak preview of something that video editor extraordinaire Brock West is working feverishly on behind the scenes, and will be available in the not-too-distant future, hopefully. But anyway, yeah, I hope you get the point. Whenever we see conspiracy theories, and why do people believe in conspiracy theories, treated in any sort of mainstream context, it is invariably to snark at the very concept, and to poo-poo it all, and to treat anyone who believes in them as some sort of paranoid crazy. Well, anyway, that's probably what you're expecting when you hear a title like Conspiracy Theory in America from a mainstream academic press. But boy, would you be wrong. So, long story short, let me put this up front, because this is not clickbait, and I'm not trying to get you to watch anything. This is a long video, so if you don't want all the details, here is the cut to the chase. Conspiracy Theory in America is an excellent book, specifically for those people who like some actual meat on the bones of the meta-analysis of political philosophy and the idea of conspiracy theory, what it actually is underneath, what it is, what that term is covering up, etc. If you want some real analysis of that, this is the book for you. If you're looking for popcorn conspiratainment about how shape-shifting lizards rule everything, this is not the book for you. But if you are into that, why are you watching The Corbett Report? So I'm going to say, if you're interested in The Corbett Report and the types of deep dive explorations that I do, you will like this book. You can now safely tune out and go on with the rest of your day doing whatever it is you normally do. For those who do like the deep dive explorations, though, let's look into this book today. But I'd like to start by setting the table for those of you who have no idea who Lance DeHaven Smith is. Well, why don't we start at, unfortunately, the end of this story. After his passing in 2022, there was this article posted up on Propaganda in Focus. It's called Remembering Lance DeHaven Smith, 1951 to 2022, which gives some basic biographical details about Lance DeHaven Smith, nay, Smith, was born in Atlanta, Georgia on April 11th, 1951, and he graduated with honors from high school, earning a letter as a member of the wrestling team. After serving in the Army as a sharpshooter, he earned a political science degree from the University of Georgia. He then matriculated to Ohio State, where he received his master's and doctorate of philosophy in political science. This article then goes through his career, starting as provost at Florida Atlantic University, a job that he hated. He eventually ended up on the faculty of Florida State University, where he served the rest of his career on the policy and public affairs programs. This article, its co-authors note that Lance was a magnificent scholar, a fiercely independent thinker, a gentle and kind spirit, and they go on to list some of his better known works, like the publication of his PhD dissertation on philosophical critiques of policy analysis, Lindblom, Habermas, and the Great Society, and the hidden teachings of Jesus, the political meaning of the kingdom of God, and the battle for Florida, an annotated compendium of materials from the 2000 presidential election, which should give you a taste of the wide variety of material that DeHaven Smith covered over the course of his career. But then we get into the meat of the matter here. 2 years later came his 2006 piece, State Crimes Against Democracy, published in a small but bold theory journal, Administrative Theory and Praxis. Lance intended that piece as a kind of theoretical digest on the work he'd done on the 2000 presidential vote fraud in Florida. He never intended to go farther with it, until encouraged by a clutch of us who, reading the piece closely, realized how clear and original was his thinking on subject matter we'd been sousing out? I think they mean sussing out, since the terror spectacle of September 11th, 2001. And he goes on to note that those involved with planning and attending the two Toronto hearings in 2011, surely people in my audience know about the Toronto hearings, right? Well, there's a link there in case you don't, will recall Lance's presentation there, featuring work he would later publish with University of Texas Press, Conspiracy Theory in America. This was his 14th and final monograph, and the one he was most pleased with. The book is still the most comprehensive dissection of the weaponization of the conspiracy theory term in service of the high criminality of U.S. elites. CTIA details how conspiracy theorizing has always been an American pursuit. With Lance's characteristic alacrity, CTIA dismantles the arguments of top no-conspiracy buffs like Richard Hofstadter, and it deconstructs the technocratic sophistry of Beltway insiders like Harvard law professors Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule. Juxtaposing key thinkers of the 20th century, CTIA distinguished between conspiracy believers, like Charles Beard, who wanted anti-democratic conspiracies exposed and adjudicated, conspiracy deniers, like Karl Popper, who believed that conspiracies are rare and even more rarely effectual, and conspiracy realists, like Leo Strauss, who thought that elite conspiracies are a necessary part of governance, even in modern democratic states. It goes on to talk more about the book, which I will be doing shortly, so you can read their summarization of it at your own leisure. But let's cut to the end. Conspiracy Theory in America was a fitting swan song for the venerable professor whose health had already begun waning. In 2014, after a protracted divorce, Lance married his high school sweetheart, Janet Porter. They were in love and happy, even if it was all too fleeting. Lance would not have much time to enjoy what should have been the prime of his life. He had been diagnosed around 2011 with an uncommonly fast-progressing form of Parkinson's disease, forcing his early retirement and making it impossible for him to type or do anything that required fine motor skills. A devastating cancer diagnosis followed, at which point Lance withdrew from public life entirely before passing away in November of 2022. And it goes on to talk again about his life and his legacy. So I will recommend this particular, this overview, this obituary, as it were, for Lance DeHaven Smith. If you're unfamiliar with him, there's lots of links in there for you to pursue those other alleys of investigation and avenues of investigation, I should say, throughout his career. But let's get in today to specifically conspiracy theory in America. And why not? Let's start right at the beginning in the introduction, where he lays out what this book is, what it's about, and how it will differ from the usual type of conspiracy theory analysis that we get in the mainstream press. So in the introduction, High Crime Blind, he acknowledges this right up front. Given its title, you might think Conspiracy Theory in America is simply another addition to the long list of books criticizing conspiracy theories, or the long list of articles or videos or podcasts, right? And he goes on to talk about Richard Hofstadter, who I hope those in my audience are already familiar with, but if not, in 1964, he wrote an essay in Harper's Magazine, which coined the term the paranoid style in American politics to describe the conspiracy theories of people who believed in communist conspiracies and others. And anyway, this is an attempt to, if not refute specifically people like Hofstadter, at least to give an actual academic rigor of attention to this subject matter that does deserve academic attention. He talks about how most of this, the criticism directed at conspiracy beliefs by people like Hofstadter, is based on sentimentality about America's political leaders and institutions rather than on unbiased reasoning and objective observation. Most authors who criticize conspiracy theories not only disagree with the theory's factual claims, they find the ideas offensive. He talks about how it's a common mistake by conspiracy deniers to lump together a hodgepodge of speculations about government intrigue, declare them all conspiracy theories, and then, on the basis of the most improbable claims among them, argue that any and all unsubstantiated suspicions of elite political crimes are far-fetched fantasies destructive of public trust. Again, I'm sure everyone in my regular audience can relate to that phenomenon. Oh, you believe in this? Well, that means you're one of these crazy people who believes that it's aliens from the planet Leptor that are secretly mind-controlling everyone. Something along those lines. We've all heard that type of rhetorical argument used in everyday conversation, but where did it come from? Well, actually, the term conspiracy theory, DeHaven Smith notes here, did not exist as a phrase in everyday American conversation before 1964, the conspiracy theory label entered the American lexicon of political speech as a catch-all for criticisms of the Warren Commission's conclusion that President Kennedy was assassinated by a lone gunman with no assistance from or foreknowledge by any element of the United States government. Side note for the fact-checkers out there, no, DeHaven Smith is not making the factually incorrect claim that the term conspiracy theory literally did not exist before 1964. He is making the very demonstrable, and as he goes on to demonstrate, provable, claim that the term conspiracy theory was not part of the common American political lexicon before 67 into 1968, as he goes on to document later on in this book. We'll get into that later. He talks about how initially conspiracy theories were not an object of ridicule and hostility. Today, however, the label is employed routinely to dismiss a wide range of anti-government suspicions as symptoms of impaired thinking akin to superstition or mental illness. He then goes on to talk about Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule, who talked about the causes and cures of conspiracy theories, and talks a little bit about their analysis, or lack thereof, of the subject, and then talks about a flawed and un-American label, etc., talking about scholars and journalists have failed to notice that their use of the term to ridicule suspicions of elite political criminality betrays the civic ethos inherited from the nation's founders. And he talks about the founders, which, again, we'll get into more in great detail later, before finally we arrive at this subsection of the introduction called Naming the Taboo Topic, which introduces what I think is probably the most important contribution of this book.
Naming the Taboo Topic. In what follows, I shall attempt to reorient analysis of the phenomenon that has been assigned the derisive label of conspiracy theory. In a 2006 peer-reviewed journal article, I introduced the concept of state crime against democracy, SCAD, to displace the term conspiracy theory. I say displace rather than replace because SCAD is not another name for conspiracy theory. It is a name for the type of wrongdoing about which the conspiracy theory label discourages us from speaking. Basically, the term conspiracy theory is applied pejoratively to allegations of official wrongdoing that have not been substantiated by public officials themselves. Deployed as a pejorative put-down, the label is a verbal defense mechanism used by political elites to suppress mass suspicions that inevitably arise when shocking political crimes benefit top leaders or play into their agendas, especially when those same officials are in control of agencies responsible for preventing the events in question or for investigating them after they have occurred. In contrast, the SCAD construct does not refer to a type of allegation or suspicion. It refers to a special type of transgression, an attack from within on the political system's organizing principles. For these extremely grave crimes, America's founders used the term high crime and included in this category treason and conspiracies against the people's liberties. SCADs, high crimes, and anti-democratic conspiracies can also be called elite political crimes and elite political criminality. The SCAD construct is intended not to supersede traditional terminology or monopolize conceptualization of this phenomenon, but rather to add a descriptive term that captures with some specificity the long-recognized potential for representative democracy to be subverted by people on the inside, the very people who have been entrusted to uphold the constitutional order.
Yes, this, I think, is the core heart, the beating heart of this book, SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy, which Lance DeHaven Smith posits is a way of reframing the discussion that has been so effectively framed for us by that pejorative put-down label, conspiracy theory. And as he is careful to note, this state crimes against democracy construct is a construct that is helpful for examining certain types of actions, but it is not meant as a catch-all that explains everything happening in the world. Of course not. Also, it is not meant to replace the term conspiracy theory, because it is not synonymous with that term and everything that it denotes as well as connotes in the public imagination. Instead, this is a very specific subset of analysis. So once again, he goes on to say, SCADs are defined as concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. Now, it is important to understand what this SCAD concept does and doesn't do. What it does is reframe the discussion as specifically, rather than some sort of theory about conspiracy, which all we know from that term is that this is something about someone theorizing about more than one person plotting to do something illegal. All right, well, that doesn't tell us very much. And the only key part of that definitionally is that there is some sort of illegal or illicit action happening and that it involves more than one person. That doesn't seem to really give you much to go on, however, whereas SCAD specifically reframes the discussion around the concept of a criminal investigation into criminal activities that are taking place by identifiable individuals for specific, well-defined motives and goals, which definitely helps to narrow down the discussion on specific events, which obviously he does throughout this book. I should note that it is important for me to note, as obviously a voluntarist, to the few voluntarists in the crowd. I note with consternation that most of my audience is still statist, but don't worry, there's time. You'll come around to the truth eventually. But for the voluntarists in the crowd, it is important to note, of course, that we should not be throwing out baby with bathwater. State crimes against democracy. Well, who cares about democracy? Well, I have no doubt that DeHaven Smith was a statist who did believe in that ideal of democracy in the usual way. But the point of SCAD is not necessarily to that democracy is some sort of the ideal virtue of, or that government is good. In fact, this is a warning that precisely because there is so much power invested in the political system as it exists in political institutions, that is precisely where psychopathic individuals will go in order to most effectively exert their influence on society. Of course, they will be attracted to those positions inside of that political construct so that they can then subvert it against the people who are using it for the noble, wonderful ideals that they believe they're using it for. And so really, as a simply an objective analysis of what is happening, the SCAD construct is true. The only question then is one of interpretation, whether that means, well, then we need to restore democracy and democratic institutions, or whether we need to get rid of the gold, the brass ring of power itself and throw it, cast it into the fires of Mordor, because it is itself the problem. But anyway, that's a matter of interpretation and analysis on top of the SCAD construct itself, which holds true whether you are a statist or a voluntarist. Anyway, I felt I needed to put that in before people start getting losing the plot here and misunderstanding what the value that this SCAD construct really brings to the conversation with regards to quote-unquote conspiracy theorizing. So, as I say, long story short, this is a good book. You should read it now. Let's get into the details. I'm not going to go through every page, page by page, and read you all the highlights that I have taken in this book, but I will go through and give you a little taste of each chapter of this book and what it talks about. So let's start with chapter one, which is the conspiracy theory label, which starts by noting that perhaps the Rosetta Stone for understanding the conspiracy theory term as it has been shoved down the American public's throat, and I would say worldwide, at least in the English-speaking world over the past 60 years or so, is the JFK assassination. And he notes that it was in that context that the CIA launched a campaign to popularize the term conspiracy theory and make conspiracy belief a target of ridicule and hostility. And he goes on in chapter four in much greater detail about that program and how it was affected. We'll get into that later, but long story short, he posits that the program to insert that phrase was successful because although the majority of the public doesn't buy the lone gunman, Warren Commission, magic bullet, fantasy land hypothesis, with all of its nut jobbery and absolute easily debunkable baloney, the CIA was successful because they certainly sowed uncertainty about the critics of things like the Warren Commission. Cranks and nut jobs and weirdos and fringe minority and all of the things that are applied and have been applied as labels to anyone who dares to question authority, that aspect of the propaganda psychological manipulation campaign that the CIA was launching there in the 1960s has been remarkably effective, as I'm sure, again, everyone in my regular audience can attest to in their day-to-day interactions with people. So in the subsection in chapter one, Perspectives on Conspiracy Beliefs, DeHaven Smith explains precisely why this term has been so successful and why it has so effectively derailed our thinking about the assassination and all conspiracy reality for the past half century and counting.
Perspectives on Conspiracy Beliefs. The term conspiracy theory is no ordinary phrase. It was deployed to have a certain connotation by CIA technocrats who are trained to break people psychologically, destroy relationships, tear apart governments, stir up old hatreds. These are scientists who are part of an organization that has overthrown powerful regimes and is partly responsible for the collapse of the Soviet Union. The reach of these people should never be underestimated. The conspiracy theory concept is deceptive. It seems to refer merely to speculation about a secret plot. But when it is applied to elite political crimes, it destroys context, background, and perspective. It is the conceptual equivalent of looking at an elephant through a microscope. The conspiracy theory label framed the debate about Kennedy's murder in a way that, to this day, straitjackets most thinking about political assassinations and about elite political crimes in general. By focusing on the issue of conspiracy, the conspiracy theory label posited that the most important question about the Kennedy assassination was how many people were involved, and typically this was interpreted to mean how many shooters. It did not matter which side of this issue people were on. Whether they were conspiracy believers or conspiracy deniers, they had swallowed the premise that the number of shooters was the decisive issue. This became the central question in investigations of the Kennedy assassination by the government, as well as by the government's critics. Indeed, it has been the focus of inquiries into almost all political assassinations and assassination attempts since then, including those of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, Ronald Reagan, and the five people killed and two U.S. senators targeted by the anthrax letter attacks. The constraints on insight imposed by the conspiracy theory framing of political crimes are difficult to see until the Kennedy assassination is approached as a suspected SCAD, that is, as a crime possibly committed by political insiders to achieve political or ideological aims they could not accomplish within the confines of existing governance institutions. The SCAD framing of the Kennedy case widens the angle of inquiry, telescoping out from the shooting, rising above the scene of the crime, and bringing into view the larger context of elite rivalries, power struggles, groups with skills displayed in the murder, and perhaps other political crimes with similar characteristics.
The rest of Chapter 1, as you can explore at your own leisure, is a thorough examination of various aspects of the JFK assassination if the SCAD construct were applied to it, and the types of elite rivalries and power struggles that we could see in light of that very construct. So, DeHaven Smith talks, for example, about LBJ, Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson's very suspicious behavior surrounding the events of the assassination. He thoroughly dismantles and eviscerates the magic bullet theory ludicrous proposal that came up, of course, as a central tenet of the Warren Commission and its hypothesis of the lone gunman. He completely undermines the denier retort, but someone would have talked. And he explains why the conspiracy theory label, specifically in this context, is fundamentally flawed, where he writes, quote, "Critics of conspiracy theorizing continue to arrive at unworkable definitions because they're trying to identify a way of thinking about political intrigue that is irrational per se. Whereas in reality, there is nothing inherently irrational about suspicion directed at powerful persons. It all depends on the nature of the allegation, the evidence for and against it, the context supporting suspicion or trust, and so on. Consequently, there is no alternative but to engage each conspiracy theory on its merits," which is, end quote, which is a point that I come back to time and time and time again in my work. Yes, some conspiracy theories are outrageous and not evidence-supported, and some conspiracy theories are incredibly well-supported and well-attested to by the evidence. So you have to judge each theory on its merits, right? Or you can approach it as a criminal investigation, like a state crime against democracy. So throughout the chapter, DeHaven Smith demonstrates how a SCAD hypothesis of the JFK assassination would work. He shows, for example, how it makes sense of otherwise inexplicable breaks of standard operating procedures that took place in and around those events. For example, the destruction of and removal of crime scene evidence. Most notably, JFK's body itself, which, of course, infamously was abducted from Parkland Hospital by armed Secret Service agents to be flown away to Washington before an independent autopsy could be conducted, which, of course, was completely illegal, totally, utterly on its face illegal, which they knew, which is precisely why it was done under armed guard and with the intended threat and violence of the Secret Service behind it. They knew they were abducting a body completely illegally. They did it anyway. Why? Well, they were just so heartbroken over the death of the president. Or was there and concerted effort to cover up a state crime against democracy taking place, which hypothesis better fits the evidence? SCAD also, for example, as he points out, explains how other post-JFK event actions, like the passing of the 25th Amendment, which, amongst other things, resolved that very problem of the illegality of abducting JFK's body by making it federal jurisdiction. Now, if somebody kills a president, well, the body is now federal jurisdiction, and they can fly him away to Washington to have their own military doctors conduct their fake autopsies without having to even break the law or use threats of intimidation or violence in order to do so. Yay, which is, of course, very convenient if you are, say, a political insider who's looking to commit a coup d'etat. Anyway, these are the sorts of issues that come into focus when we use that much closer analysis of the SCAD construct in order to understand what's going on here. I'll say, okay, so moving on to chapter two, the American tradition of conspiracy belief. This chapter deals with, as you might tell from that title, the fact that the founding fathers of the U.S. were conspiracy theorists. Oh my God. Do you remember Corbett Report Radio episode number 183, Meet the Conspiracy Theorists, from 14 years ago or whenever that was? If not, this would be a good time for you to reacquaint yourself with that material. But long story short, as I went through in that very edition of Corbett Report Radio, yes, of course, the founding fathers were conspiracy theorists. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory backed document. Really, it's a there was a conspiracy. This series of abuses by King George and his henchmen were not just random events. They were part of a concerted plot to reduce the colonies into absolute tyranny. That was the conspiracy theory on which the founding fathers pledged their life, their liberty, and their sacred honor, whatever that phrase is. So that is just the plain facts of that. But beyond that, those facts, of course, it does inform everything that came after it in the founding of the United States and the Republic. So DeHaven Smith explains how this conspiracy realism, the integral core part of the U.S., became a looming presence in deliberations over not only how best to set up the new government, but going on from there. And then he talks about, in this chapter, a subject that is oddly relevant today, the Sedition Act of 1798 and the Burr Conspiracy. Sedition Act. Where have I heard about that in the news lately? Oh, that's right. We could take it, for example, from this post up recently to the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org. Trump revives the Alien and Sedition Acts, which is talking about the growing threat of the criminalization of political speech and political wrongthink in Trump's America, in which America with the three Ks, in which, yes, it is now illegal crime think for a legal resident of the United States to dare to question the motives of, say, the Israeli government and what is happening in Gaza, the genocide that is taking place. Correctly identifying that phenomenon is now grounds to have you deported on the basis of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, which was passed along with the Sedition Act, which the Sedition Act was later repealed, but it's being revived because everything old is new again. And I suppose there are those in the audience who may question, well, who cares? What's so bad about deporting greenholders who espouse these evil anti-Semitic ideas? Like, I don't know, Palestinian life is worth saving. Oh, you're a horrible criminal who deserves to be deported for having those thoughts. Well, this particular section of Chapter 2 goes into detail about where the Sedition Act came from, the ethos behind it, and the types of people who were promulgating it at the time.
The Sedition Act of 1798 and the Burr Conspiracy. In the late 1790s, the founders confronted mass suspicions similar to those faced by political leaders today who see conspiracy theories as paranoid and pernicious. The founders' response is instructive, and when compared to contemporary derision of conspiracy belief, a sad indication of how far the quality of American leadership and journalism has fallen. Although the founders became polarized over foreign policy and flirted with censorship and suppression of dissent, they quickly came to the conclusion that freedom of speech must be protected, even if, or especially if, it maligns the government or insults the integrity of public officials. As the constitutional order took form in the first decade after the U.S. Constitution became effective in 1789, questions arose about whether limits should be placed on anti-government speech inciting sedition or rebellion against the new political system. British common law designated seditious libel, statements critical of the government or its officials, as a crime subject to severe punishments, with the truth of such statements inadmissible as a defense. During medieval times, trials for seditious libel were conducted in the notorious Star Chamber, in which proceedings were secret, defendants could be compelled to testify against themselves, and defendants could not confront and cross-examine their accusers. A number of rights codified in the U.S. Constitution were included precisely to prevent such practices in America. The right against self-incrimination, Amendment 5, the guarantee of trial by jury, Amendments 6 and 7, and the right to confront one's accusers, Amendment 6. Further protection for political speech was afforded by limiting treason to an overt act.
As I say, that segment just kind of jumped out at me this time rereading the book because of what is passing through the news wires right now. But yes, as any conspiracy realist worth his or her salt will know, that of course, any power given to politicians to determine political acceptable speech and unacceptable speech will be used against you and whatever it is that you think about the reality of those in power conspiring to expand their riches, wealth, and power over you. Of course, they are going to use it for those purposes, and that is what the American system itself was founded on at the time, and that is what is being dismantled in front of our eyes by the Make Israel Great Again Trump administration, who are trying to criminalize, criminalize the criticism of Israel. You cannot do that. That is anti-Semitic. It will get you deported from the country if you so much as think about it. So anyway, anyone who, as I say, is a conspiracy realist will understand what is really going on here and the stakes involved. And as I say, chapter 2 is a continued exploration of that theme, that idea of the founding principles of the United States and the something that was very much on the forefront of the public conversation at that time was conspiracy realism about how oligarchs and oligarchies form and consolidate power and control, and how that continued to inform, at the very least, the populist understanding of government and fear of government, or at least fear is the wrong word, but understanding of the real nature of government that did inform the public conversation up until, well, at least the World War II era, as DeHaven Smith gets into in chapters 3 and 4. But in chapter 2, he continues to talk about how this concept, the conspiracy realism ethos, continued to inform populist understanding of the government through the development of political parties and the development of political machines and the Iron Triangle and the political economic complexes that developed over time, of course, like the military-industrial complex, but others as well. And, well, anyway, it's a fascinating bit of history, and it does, I think, effectively make the point that conspiracy theorizing is far from some fringe weird thing that was introduced by foreign elements into the United States in the 1950s or something. No, it was something that was there from the beginning. And as a little bonus, if you want to know anything about the aforementioned Burr conspiracy, well, you'll have to read the rest of that chapter. But let's move on to chapter 3, where DeHaven Smith confronts conspiracy denial in the social sciences, which is an extended compare and contrast, essentially, between three competing post-World War II sociopolitical schools of thought, each of which represented a competing view of society that provides subtly different but wildly diverging claims about history. And so he looks at three thinkers in particular who exemplify these strains of thought. One, he points out, is Charles Beard, who DeHaven Smith presents as sort of the exemplar of pre-World War II academia, in which conspiratorial interpretations of history were, at the very least, permissible, thinkable, it was possible to be a mainstream academic and to entertain such ideas. And he gives, as an example, Beard's hypothesis that the 14th Amendment was adopted specifically by, written and steered through Congress by railroad-connected congressmen to grant the rights of individuals to corporations, obviously for the interests of their railroad corporation backers. That's just one example of the Beard school of sociopolitical / historical analysis, historical conspiratorial realism. But that, as DeHaven Smith posits, was undermined by a couple of post-World War II sociological thinkers who gained traction post-World War II. Karl Popper, who dismisses conspiracy theorizing altogether as a modern version of ooga-booga superstition, And not only did he dismiss it as being wrong, he dismissed it as being dangerous because it was the type of thing that enabled the witch hunts that led to political demagoguery and ultimately tyrannical government. For what it's worth, the Haven Smith points out that Popper's argument, despite Popper being this paragon of rationality and scientific thinking, it's ridiculous, Popper's argument, because it relies on the idea that conspiratorial explanations of history depend on the view that every event is the result of a conspiracy that worked nonetheless, which is clearly false, and therefore he dismisses any conspiratorial explanation of any historical event, which is, of course, logically completely the wrong way around. But anyway, that being what it is, the other thinker that David Smith talks about in Chapter 3 is Leo Strauss, who I know the clued-in listeners to the Corbett Report will probably recognize as the philosophical predecessor, godfather of the neocons, but specifically was a socio-political thinker who argued that the noble lie was necessary to keep the public motivated, specifically for continued Western, by which he meant, of course, American dominance in the world. And that's an interesting subset of exploration, really, especially at this time, because this dissection of Strauss is so important in this era specifically, when erstwhile members of the so-called independent media, even as recently as last year, I heard them arguing, well, our only role as little peons in society is to choose which oligarchs will rule over us, because they're always going to rule over us. So we got to choose the better oligarchs, the ones that don't hate us so much. And Jamie Dimon and Elon Musk and people like that, they're the good oligarchs. They like us. I literally heard independent media figures saying this during the Trump selection process to snooker conspiracy realists to get on board with choosing scum who want to rule over you. They're the good guys. They don't hate you as much as Harris and Biden, so you got to choose them. As if your choice makes any difference in any of this. Anyway, as I say, this dissection of Strauss, who was the philosophical precursor to all this line, this strain of thinking that is being repopularized, it's incredibly important. So let's take a look at just a little section of DeHaven Smith's analysis of Strauss.
Strauss's vision of history is similar to Popper's, with one important exception. Strauss agrees with Popper that societies start out with customs supported by a mythos, and that as they encounter societies with different beliefs, this mythos comes into question. But Strauss argues that if philosophy and science are allowed to utterly discredit the society's claims about its origins and about the value of its institutions and way of life, ruling elites will lose their respect for law and will abuse their powers as they compete with one another for popular support and glory. Strauss assumes that all but the most primitive societies are stratified into an elite and mass, that the elites are simply smarter, stronger, braver, and better than are the masses, and that the decisive factor in social organization is how the elites are controlled and managed. For the most part, he thinks the latter depends on the elite's reverence, or lack thereof, for the established laws and traditions. Elites who revere their society's values and norms will be magnanimous, restrained, and caring. When traditional beliefs erode, the elites become gangsters, and eventually one gangster rises through guile and brutality to the top, thus establishing tyranny. Therefore, whereas Popper envisions as the endpoint of societal development a totally open society without superstition, Strauss says such a society is not possible in the long run, because it would eventually become totalitarian, or, in Strauss's terms, tyrannical. Democracy and respect for human dignity depend on salutary myths and noble lies that must be propagated by a special class of philosophical elites, who are dedicated to guarding the society's values and traditions. Strauss never defines what he means by noble lies, beyond referring to Plato's The Republic, which is where the term originates. But this was certainly no oversight on Strauss's part, for it leaves the matter open, which is to say, unlimited. For Plato, noble lies included myths and stories about the society's origins, rigged lotteries for choosing marriage partners, infanticide, and other actions to create a strong people willing and able to defend themselves in a hostile world. This short list would seem to imply support for many anti-democratic elite conspiracies, including assassinating political leaders, framing dissidents, fomenting mass fear, demonizing rival societies, and letting enemy attacks succeed so that the masses are galvanized to deal with a gathering threat. The upshot for modern democracies is that political leaders must conspire to manipulate mass opinion and reinforce patriotism, reverence for the founders, religious faith and piety, and generally love of one's own. Like science and philosophy, conspiracy theories or dastardly truths are corrosive of political cohesion and the rule of traditional law because they undermine authority and raise doubts about foundational stories extolling the society's founders and rules. Thus, from a Straussian perspective, conspiracy theories pose an existential threat to the social order, not because they are mistaken, but because they are likely to be true, and of course, being true, difficult to refute.
Now, as I say, I think that exploration, specifically of Strauss's thinking, is incredibly important at this time, because, of course, I do see the tendency amongst certain sectors of the conspiracy realist space of, oh no, I'm the real hard-nosed realist that understands that violence and power and oligarchs are just a fact of reality, and you better get used to it, because people are gonna use violence to inflict their will on you, so you better be one of the violent, strong few who are powerful enough to make it through. I see people getting essentially swayed by that dark side enticement. But power and violence is the only organizing principle of society. And the inevitable endpoint of that line of thinking is that you will ultimately decide, actually, you know, the conspirators are right, that they need to commit conspiracies. Because the endpoint of that line of thinking, power, might makes right, and power and violence is the only thing that gets things done, is that inevitably you start to realize, well, okay, you cannot control a society, including all of the people in that society, including lots of people like myself, who do not concede their sovereignty and their power over to some oligarchical clique. You're going to have to find a way to rule over these people, so you better fabricate myths and narratives that the public can go along with that will lead them towards the goal that you have in mind. And you're powerful enough to make those things happen. So you will inevitably side with the conspirators if you go down that dark path. And I think that's an important thing that DeHaven Smith really brings out in this chapter. For whatever it's worth, as something of a philosophy buff, political philosophy buff, I found chapter 3 particularly interesting. So if you're that way inclined, I think you will too. But if you want more specifically about conspiracy theorizing, well, then let's get into chapter 4, the conspiracy theory conspiracy, which is a chapter-length exploration of how the conspiracy theory label, as a pejorative, was seeded into the public consciousness. So, of course, it inevitably, as I'm sure you suspected, goes into great depth of detail in discussion of CIA dispatch 1035-960, which I note I have linked to, I have discussed many times in Corbett Report history, most recently in episode 474 of this podcast, What I Learned from the JFK Files. I did include the link to that very document there. I'll include it here as well, because it is a perennially interesting document for those of us in the conspiracy realist space. But DeHaven Smith breaks it down in a number of novel and instructive ways that I haven't seen others talking about, even noting, as almost as an aside, that as a document written by spies for spies, it is certainly not meant to be taken simply at surface level, because when you read the document, as I hope you have by now, you will know, well, I'm not sure exactly that this is the type of, you know, Rosetta Stone for conspiracy theory that people have portrayed it as. Well, because there are multiple levels and layers of meaning going on here, which DeHaven Smith spends an entire chapter breaking down in great detail. For example, he points out, and I don't think he was drawing any conclusion from this, but he points out even the seemingly innocuous dispatch 1035-960. Dash? Well, what does that mean? I've never even thought to question that particular moniker. Well, surely it's just a CIA dispatch numbering system, and it's just sequential, right? Well, as DeHaven Smith points out, not necessarily. Even something as innocuous as that, there could be an encoded meaning in 1035-960? -960? What does that actually mean? Anyway, that's mostly as an aside, but it is one way to reframe our thinking when we're looking at a document like this. Again, as he notes, as a document written by spies for other spies, of course it is going to have multiple layers of meaning. So he goes through a point-by-point examination of the dispatch, including a detailed look at how it posits that RFK's silence on the JFK issue, at least as it existed there in 1967 when this document was written, is therefore the strongest proof of all that no plot could have existed, because surely RFK would have spoken up about it, a point which we can debunk now with, you know, the benefit of access to the archives and the hindsight that comes with them, that RFK in fact did not go along with the JFK assassination mythos and was absolutely intending to reopen that investigation when he became president. But then something intervened. And he points, DeHaven Smith, in his analysis, points out how a specific example of how this dispatch and its seeding of that conspiracy theorist label and the pejorative put-down that it implied was used specifically by John P. Roche, a special assistant to LBJ, to great effect in a review of a JFK assassination book that was published. The review was published by the London Times Literary Supplement. So you see, this is the CIA giving media advice to its media agents around the world. It's nothing to do with propagandizing Americans at home, except for the fact that Roche's London Times Literary Supplement piece was then, of course, heavily publicized in America and picked up by Time and others, as DeHaven Smith points out. Anyway, he then goes on to quantify the effect of CIA Dispatch 1035-960. I always, in my discussion of this document, I always sort of vaguely refer to the fact that the term conspiracy theory, yes, it was not invented by the CIA in 1967. It did not start with this document. You can find examples of it pre-1967. But the seeding of it as a everyday term in regular political analysis and discourse does stem from this document. I always kind of vaguely refer to the fact that it hardly ever appeared before this, and then it was prevalent afterward. Well, DeHaven Smith quantifies it, including in a chart that Brock will display on screen here, noting the annual number of stories mentioning conspiracy theory as a set term, with Boolean operators and all, over time. And yeah, there's definitely a marked spike after 1967, is there not? And he goes on to quantify it in other ways and put numbers to it and break it down. He points out, for example, that the surprising statistic that roughly 25% of all New York Times stories that mention conspiracy theory today appear in the sports pages. And he points out how the rapid spread of this term to sports and business and other areas of life just shows how effective it has been in spreading doubts about the intended target of this smear, the conspiracy theorists. Whether that is in the political realm or whether that's in sports or anything else, of course, anyone positing a conspiracy theory is a crack, a loon, someone who can be dismissed without argumentation simply by the application of the label. It has been remarkably effective in that way. And so that brings us to what I think really is the heart of this book, Chapter 5, State Crimes Against Democracy, the chapter-length exploration of essentially, I think, the real thesis of this book, the not replacing, but the displacing of the conspiracy theory mind-stopper cliché with a different term, a different analysis, State Crimes Against Democracy, the SCAD construct. So I am not going to spoil anything here. You have to read it to understand and appreciate it in its full context. I will just tease it with this subsection from that chapter 5 on the victim's perspective.
The victim's perspective. The SCAD concept is intended to function like a corrective lens, to shift the standpoint and widen the angle of political crime observation. In effect, everyday, case-by-case perceptions of assassinations, defense failures, election fiascos, and similar events view these events from the perspective of a victim, a perspective that magnifies the threat and/or the vulnerability of the target. The victim's perspective is frequently evident in the photographic images of SCADs that become iconographic. President and Mrs. Kennedy in their limo with the Texas School Book Depository rising above them in the background. A close-up full-body picture taken from below eye level of Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle. Robert Kennedy prostrate on the floor, dying, surrounded by horrified onlookers. To this day, when we are reminded of 9/11, the images that come to mind see the destruction from below. If they are images of the Twin Towers, their perspective is from street level, looking up. Of course, in the case of 9/11, the natural tendency to magnify the threat and see it from below was enhanced by the fact that the threat came from the sky. But it was also abetted by a decision of the U.S. government to sequester photos that looked down on the carnage. Before, during, and after the Twin Towers imploded, thousands of photos were taken of the World Trade Center from a police helicopter flying overhead. These are the only images in existence that show the destruction from above. And yet the photos were withheld from the public for over 8 years.
If you are interested in hearing more of that, I will, of course, invite you to explore the rest of chapter 5, 6? Where are we? Chapter 5, at your own leisure and in your own time. But suffice it to say, yes, the SCAD construct brings with it a completely different conceptualization of the idea of conspiracies and what they are, or at least certain types of conspiracies. And later on in the chapter, he does specifically lay that out. He says, quote, "Americans are largely unaware of it, but they have been trained by the nation's increasingly defensive political elites, with the help of a complicit media, to avoid seeing or looking for connections between political crimes. In contrast, SCAD research begins by looking at SCADs and suspected SCADs collectively and comparatively." And, end quote. And that is an important point, perhaps more so than it appears at first glance. He points out, for example, how we talk about the JFK assassination, and we talk about the RFK assassination, but we never talk about the Kennedy assassinations. We do not have that nomenclature, at least in the general public vernacular, that is that way of linking in the public's minds. Oh, these two brothers, one president, one about to become president, were both assassinated at the prime of their political career. I wonder if there's any sort of link between them. No, we even in their very nomenclature keep them separated and different as completely separate events that have to be examined completely separately, as opposed to the Kennedy assassinations, which, if that was the term that had been used to describe those events, well, that would present a different, potentially a state crimes against democracy, a SCAD construct way of viewing and looking at those events collectively, comparatively, etc. And it's not just that. For example, he points out a number of things in this chapter about election rigging and assassination research and the anthrax attacks and 9/11. And they're very interesting ways of looking at all of those through the SCAD lens and how that can be applied. So again, please do read the chapter if you are interested in that analysis. I will just throw in just a tiny part of that analysis that I thought was actually unusually prescient. He goes on to talk about memes and how they are used psychologically as tools of manipulation, that memes of even names and nomenclature are embedded in the public consciousness, seeded into the public consciousness by media mouthpieces and gatekeepers in order to control the public's perception of events. And he gives as an example, which, again, it's a great piece of analysis, where he points out even the naming convention of 9/11 is itself an anomaly that should give us pause for thought. No other event in American history, with the possible exception of July 4th, the 4th of July, is named after the date upon which it took place. There is no, I don't even remember, is it December 7th? The date that will live in infamy is, yeah, Pearl Harbor. We talk about Pearl Harbor. We don't talk about December 7th or whatever it is, 12/7. And yes, even the fact that it's a numeral, again, even differentiates it even from the 4th of July. The 4th of July is the 4th of July. But 9/11 is 9/11. The numbers are used to refer to that date, which is completely unique, at least in the American political discourse. Why? And he gives an analysis of that and what it could potentially mean, And more broadly, he talks about memes and ideas and how they are seeded into the public consciousness, which I will point out that given that this book was published in 2014, largely written before 2014, it was remarkably foresightful and insightful, because not a lot of people were talking about memes. Not a lot of people could even pronounce memes back in 2014, if you might recall, back when people were still saying meme, because they had never heard the word said out loud. So DeHaven Smith, I think, was on the ball with that particular piece of analysis, but also just generally. There's a lot of analysis here on a lot of different fronts. Which brings us to the final chapter of the book, Chapter 6, Restoring American Democracy, about DeHaven Smith's idea for righting the wrongs of the various scads that have been perpetrated specifically in the U.S. over the past century, and how people can restore American democracy. Now, as a non-American, and more to the point, a non-statist, I would no doubt have my differences of opinion regarding the real solutions to these scads. But as I say, that is the layer of analysis that goes on top of the construct. The construct itself is incredibly valuable, and I think definitely worth your time and attention. And hey, I think that at the very least, Chapter 6 is certainly worth reviewing, and there are things in there that I would no doubt agree with, as well as disagree with. Now, having said all of that, I did open today's exploration by talking about SCAD. You don't know what SCAD is? Come on. State crimes against democracy, and how that might be a different way of framing things. I use the term conspiracy realist, but SCAD or SCAD realist, maybe that's a different way of framing it. I tend to think conspiracy realist, at least for the time being, at least until we can actually propagate the SCAD construct idea out into the general public, conspiracy realist is probably more effective because it undermines that set phrase that everybody knows, and everybody knows the implied meaning of, more importantly even than the actual meaning, conspiracy theorist. Well, when you suddenly stop, when you break that circuit, conspiracy realist, wait, what are you saying? I think that it can be more effective. Now, to be fair, DeHaven Smith has his own definition of conspiracy realist here in that he presents in Chapter 6 specifically, that is very, very different than my definition that I'm using. I think a conspiracy realist is someone who understands conspiracies do take place, so it is our job as researchers, informed people, in order to understand what is happening in the world and to be realistic about it, we have to understand that conspiracies take place, we have to research them, we have to acknowledge the reality of conspiracies. DeHaven Smith uses that phrase in a very different way, to refer to people like Strauss and the Straussians, who think that conspiracies, of course they exist, because they should exist, because we need to manipulate the public. So he uses it in a pejorative sense, really, as the kind of the mirror of the conspiracy theorist, conspiracy realist. It's a pejorative that he's using. I use it in a different way. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Long story short, this is an important contribution to conspiracy literature. I could not recommend this book enough for people who are interested in this subject or the types of things that I have teased today, but trust me, you do not know the book if you have not read the book. I have only teased certain ideas and concepts, but the rest of the book, well, is waiting there for you to explore at your time, at your leisure. I think you will enjoy it if you enjoyed anything from today's teasing exploration. So I'm giving this book a 10 out of 10. Why isn't it on your bookshelf? Having said all of that, of course, all the notes that I've referred to today will be in the show notes at the Corbett Report website, as well as the comments. And today specifically, I would like to invite people who have read the book. I would be very interested to hear your analysis of it. If you haven't read the book, I'm not interested in your analysis of what you have heard today, because you do not understand this in its full context. Why would anyone care what someone who hasn't read the book thinks about the book? No, if you have read the book, please do. Please do leave your comments in the comment section at CorbettReport.com. Of course, as always, members are invited to log in and leave those thoughts in the comment section. Having said that, I think that's going to do it for this exploration. The whole point today is to get you motivated to actually read this book, so I hope you do so. Again, the links will be in the show notes. That's going to do it for today. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, signing off for now.
The deep state. False flags. 9/11 truth. The Federal Reserve. Secret wars and hidden histories. fake news, medical martial law, ceaseless propaganda. James Corbett, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. Available where books are sold, until they're not.
ReportageBook.com.